Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. My Girl, the amazing harmonies of the Temptations. Close your eyes. No, not you people who are driving. Signature music. This is everything from first love car radio memories to something darker, even the soundtrack to a film about Vietnam. You can hear the fingers snapping, see the Temptations singing, but who's playing the music? The distinctive sound of Motown can be heard in the songs of marquee artists like Diana Ross, Stevie Wonder, Mary Wells, but that distinction ultimately comes from the underlying music. That's our behind-the-music story today. The studio musicians of Motown who laid down the groove. They're called the Funk Brothers. James Jamerson on bass, Benny Benjamin on the drums, Joe Hunter's keyboard, and Jack Ashford's signature tambourine and vibes. Connection listeners, you've been listening to their work since the late 1950s, if you're that old. But do you know the musicians behind the music? The dozen or so guys from Detroit who are the musical engine behind what has been, quite accurately called, the greatest hit machine in modern music. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Now, joining us today from a studio in Philadelphia, two of the original Funk Brothers, Jack Ashford and Joe Hunter, and the man whose research, writing, and musical skills made sure that the Funk Brothers are not passing unknown into history, Alan Slutsky's also with us. He's the author of Standing in the Shadows of Motown. It's a book he wrote some 13 years ago, and the film version about the Funk Brothers, also called Standing in the Shadows of Motown, is being released next month. So, Jack and Joe and Alan, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Nice to be here.
I want to start by going back. I want to just hear that opening guitar line from My Girl.
That's probably one of the more recognizable guitar licks of the early Motown days. And when I originally played it 27 years ago, I didn't think much about it, only that it worked.
And that's the voice of Robert White, who passed on in 1994. Alan Slutsky, you feature him in the book and in the film. And I guess, as you point out, it was that one guitar lick and that musician who got the film going.
Yeah, well, when Robert passed away, I had already been searching for funding for 5 years, but that's when I kicked it into high gear, because Robert was kind of the poster boy for the four-decade-long yearning that these guys had for recognition. And I felt like I had let him down, that I couldn't get it for him during his lifetime. So even though I knew I hadn't, you know, I'd been working my brains out, but I just kicked it into another level at that point.
Jack Ashford, was it always a source of some frustration that the singers would get the attention and the musicians did not?
No, we didn't think about the singers then, because when we recorded, they were never around. So we really didn't, unless they came and worked the club that we were working locally in Detroit, we would see them then. But when we saw them, we bonded very well. But we were more interested in the playing, because that was all we did. Night and day we played, 7 days a week.
Now, you went into this Studio A, the place called the Snake Pit. Is that right? That was your home.
Yes.
Were you guys paid a lot of money?
A lot of money?
Yeah, like how much were you making for a song back then?
I'm embarrassed. No. Well, according to today's standards, it was very monastic. But at that time, we had so many gigs we were doing, until even the money we were paid may not have been what we wanted it to be, But we made so many gigs until we were satisfied.
Because you were playing clubs at the same time, right?
Right. We were happy playing music. We loved our instruments. We loved our craft. And we loved what we were doing. And we were big time in Detroit.
Yeah, it really ran the gamut. Because in the early days, when Joe first came in, they were paying like $5 or $10 a side. And by the end, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, James Jamerson and Earl Van Dyke were on retainer for $52,000 a year, which was good money back then.
Joe, a little bit of history here. Now, you're originally from Jackson, Tennessee, is that right?
Correct.
You went to Detroit after the war to play music or to get a job in a car factory?
No, I went to Detroit about 3 days before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor.
Ah, okay.
And I was 11 years old then, going to my 12th birthday, and there I went, finished grammar school, and then went to finish high school. Excuse me, that's okay. Let's finish high school, and then actually went into the military. That's where I met Earl Van Dyke, one of the great piano players that worked at Motown.
But you brought this gang of musicians together in some way, didn't you?
Some of them, not all of them. Barry always, he knew Benny probably before he knew me. Benny Papacito, we call him. And I met Barry when I left for Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. Ever remember Hank Ballard and the Midnighters? I worked with him 2 years. The one that put out Work With Me, Annie. Anyway, I worked with Hank for 2 years, and after I left Hank Ballard, the bass player had left also with Hank Ballard, and he told Barry about me and where I was working and so forth, and Barry came by where I was working and told me what he was about, and that's how I got to Motown. Was through Gordy himself, invited me to become a part of his program.
Now, one of the things that, Joe, that you and Jack both did as a result of the film was you went back to 2648 West Grand Boulevard. You went back to Hitsville to Studio A to talk to amongst yourselves, among the other surviving members of the Funk Brothers. Can you two tell me what it was like going back into that place after being away for so many years?
It was just a strange feeling. Seeing that place again and seeing those same faces looking a little older than we did the last time I'd seen them in that building. We were in that building when we were young people, you know. So we went back. We were a lot older and grandkids and things like that. It was a whole litany of emotions going through us at the same time. We had to get prepared to do the session that Alan had set up, you know. So it was a lot to absorb in a short span of time. But by them trying to maintain the image and the picture that it once had, you know, it was really spooky, really, really strange feeling.
Joe?
He said it just about right. When I came there, it was a spooky feeling. And actually, I could see the faces of some of the Funk Brothers that passed, like Bungo Eden, Earl Van Dyke, and Jameson, Papacito, Benjamin, and that was it. It was a spooky thing, but Jack is very spiritual and religious, and he could feel the prayers of Barry Gordy when he walked in there, and I felt the same thing, practically.
Alan Slusky, you managed to capture the camera captures the look on the faces of the Funk Brothers as they enter this time capsule.
Yeah, well, there's actually two shots that set it up. One was the director, Paul Justman, was just, you know, he knew while the main cameras were being set up, he just walked around with his digital camera all the time shooting things. And he knew as they were setting up the dolly tracks down in the snake pit that these guys were overcome. So he caught Jack and Joe Messina in a hallway and on just a digital camera, but we wound up using that. And then once the dolly tracks were there, we kept the guys out of the snake pit until it was all set up, and then we let them come down one by one. And you could see in their face, it was like, you know, they're walking into Disney World. And it really comes through on the film.
Now, Connection listeners, the voice you're hearing there is Martha and the Vandellas, but the keyboard you're listening to is being played by my guest Joe Hunter, the song Heatwave, 1963. So we're asking you to listen behind the singer to the music that is backing her up. Joe Hunter, when you're trying to figure out what it was that you had, you and the Funk Brothers, how do you describe the tight sound, the groove that you guys were able to create?
Well, we had a sort of a chemistry. If one person could come in and do a thing, we could just about feel what we were supposed to do. We had the chord charts and everything laying out before us, very little notation on the charts. And like Brian Holland, when I went in that particular time for that studio of Heatwave, he had a chart out and asked me what kind of beat that I would be doing on the piano. So we walked over the piano, and the only thing I felt was, for myself, was a Charleston beat. And that's what he told me to go ahead with. That's the way it came out, and I did the Charleston beat on the piano that you're hearing now. Boom, boom.
Let's listen a bit.
Boom.
Jack Ashford, when you think about all the time that you spend in the snake pit backing up creating all the music that was the backup for those artists, do you look back on it as a job or something that was fun to do every day?
No, fortunately, by looking back, you can see the value of it more clear than you did then, you know, because then it was just a gig. Now it's history. So, you know, I'm proud of what we did. It was a wonderful experience. And, it's just that we're getting an opportunity to relive it, and that's the mystical part about it, because you usually don't get a chance to correct anything in life that you've done or get a chance to relive any of the glory of anything that you'd ever done. And we're getting an opportunity to do that, and we're very thankful to God that, you know, we're doing that.
It comes a bit late, but it comes anyway, right?
Yes. Yes.
Connection listener, our number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Stop. In the Name of Love. Diana Ross and the Supremes, Marvin Gaye, the Four Tops, Stevie Wonder, Smokey Robinson, the Miracles, the Temptations, the Marvelettes. They are the musicians of a time, and the musicians who back those musicians are the Funk Brothers. They are the subject of a brand new film, Standing in the Shadow of Motown, based on a book by Alan Slutsky. And Connection listeners, why is it that we get so mesmerized by the marquee artists and look past the unbelievable talent that puts those people where they are just because the names don't show up in the liner notes? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Are we past that now in music? Are we marking the union stations behind the Alison Krauss, or is this still a plague in the music industry? 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Catch the bass line. The song is Bernadette, the Musicians, the Funk Brothers. With me on the program, Joe Hunter, keyboard player with the Funk Brothers, Jack Ashford, percussion, tambourine, vibes, and Alan, Dr. Lick Slutsky, guitarist, author, and producer. In 1989, Alan, when you wrote the book Standing in the Shadows of Motown, you actually did zero in on the life and music of the legendary bassist, James Jamerson. He was a standout even among the people he played with.
Well, he's still a standout because he revolutionized the instrument. When electric bass was invented in the early 50s, nobody really knew what to do with it. A lot of electric basses, you would actually see them back then holding it instead of diagonally, like the instrument is meant to be played. You'd actually see them holding it vertically.
They like just a stand-up bass?
Like a stand-up bass, yeah. And they were mostly all doing the same kind of cocktail, you know, two-beat bass patterns. And then they were looking for a voice for this new instrument, and Jamerson was the first virtuoso of the electric bass. He gave it a voice. And when I did that book, the book came with two CDs of some of the world's greatest bass players, most technically gifted bass players, playing his bass lines and demonstrating, you know, and talking about them. And most of them thought it was going to be a very easy gig, just to read the transcription and right. just to lay it down. And they all had to punch in, like, every couple bars. They couldn't believe how technically difficult it was because the guy was that revolutionary and his hands were that strong.
Yeah, there's people who talk about trying to copy his lines, and they can't do it. You know, I mean, he was playing Jack, Joe, he played with one finger, a style of picking the guitar?
Yes, he did.
The hook, right?
The hook. That's it.
Yeah, we have some good close-ups in the movie where you can see his thumb, his index finger playing, and, you know, you hear a bass line like this Bernadette thing, and you figure, how is that possible to do with just one finger with all those rakes and different bass techniques they have, but it was just natural to him.
Let's hear a bit. Is it there? No, we lost it.
You hear Levi scream Bernadette. There it is.
Okay, bring it up again. Jack Ashford, Joe Hunter, the music that you folks were creating in the Snake Pit, you know, we talk about Jamerson, you can talk about the drumming of Pistol Allen, Benny Benjamin, Uriel Jones. I mean, everybody was, in a way, changing the sound of their instrument in order to work together to create the Motown sound. That's partly why people dug it so much, wasn't it?
Well, you know, when you're working with somebody like James Jamerson, he was setting the standard, and to be equivalent on your instrument, you had to reach out also. So I guess that's what kind of made everybody go way beyond the normal on their instruments in order to keep up, you know. And I was just thinking, you were talking about Papa Zita, which Joe will tell you who named the studio the Snake Pit. Well, James Jamerson named it the Funk Factory.
Is that where the name the Funk Brothers came from?
No. Benny named us the Funk Brothers, but Jamerson called it the Funk Factory. You know, another funny thing about Jamerson that no one ever talks about, if you ever shook hands with him, you would never be surprised what he could do with that one finger. He had a grip like a caveman. and he didn't try to hurt your hand, but when you shook hands with him, it was extremely powerful. He was a different kind of guy. He was truly, truly a legend and didn't even know it, didn't even act like it. I'm just so sorry that people didn't get an opportunity to experience James Jamerson's presence, because to be around him and to hear him play was an experience that I'll never forget as long as I live.
One of the voices in Standing in the Shadows of Motown is that of the drummer Uriel Jones.
People would always say everything but the musicians. They would say it was the artists, the producers, the way the building was structured, or the wood in the floor, or maybe even food. You know, but I like to see them take some barbecue ribs or hamburgers or anything and throw down in that studio, shut the door and count off 1, 2, 3, 4 and get a hit out of there. The formula was the musicians.
I get a kick out of it every time I hear that.
Yeah, me too. 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Waltham, Massachusetts. John's on the line. Hi, John.
Hello.
Thanks for calling in.
Well, you're welcome. And I just want to say that these guys were certainly not recognized enough, but musicians recognized them. I was in a rock band in college and earned my spending money that way when back in the 60s. And believe me, as the bass player, I was always listening to James Jamerson. And I was listening to that Motown beat and how the beat got turned upside down. With the snare drum was a steady count, and the bass was syncopated all over the place against the bass drum. And, man, that was so cool. And the stereo that bounced from one side to the other, from one instrument to the other, all that was just revolutionary and wonderful.
Do you remember, John, getting into conversations with people about the music that you were listening to and saying to them, you know, you got to listen past that voice of Diana Ross to hear what's going on in the background to understand why the sound sounds the way it does?
Absolutely. With a friend of mine who's gone on to be a recognized composer of classical music, you know, with all the players in my band. You know, the Motown vocalists were almost interchangeable. You'd have different versions of the same song by the different groups, but the instrumentals were there behind it, and that's what made it. It really is. It's, you know, most of the, I wouldn't say completely interchangeable, but some of the songs got several versions, and you know, you'd hear that very similar backup behind all of them, and little differences, and oh yeah, you know, there's Jamerson, he's changing it around a little for the soloist. It was just fantastic, and I still listen to it.
I wonder, John, thanks for your call. I wonder, Jack, when you reflect back on the musicians who weren't part of the Funk Brothers, but the people that whose names were on the labels, they got it in a way, didn't they? I mean, Marvin Gaye, was it Marvin Gaye who sought you out in Boston?
Yes. He came to a club that I was working at. I was working with a jazz group, Charles Harris Organ Trio. And Marvin came by, and he liked what he heard. And he, at that time, he was back in Detroit forming a band to go on the road, and gave me an offer of coming there. And so I said, well, at first they wanted to know whether I ever heard of Marvin. I told him no. And then he asked me, had I ever heard of Motown Records, because they'd had some hits out. I'd never heard of them. I never heard of Mary Wells. If they didn't blow a horn like Miles or sax like Coltrane, I didn't know them. Because, you know, I had to be engrossed in what I was in. That's where I was making my living. So I had to concentrate on jazz. And so I think because I didn't know anything is what got me the job with Motown.
Alan, if the musicians like Marvin Gaye had the ear and the wit to say, I need the Joe Hunters and the Jack Ashfords to make me sound the way I want to sound, why was it at that time that the names didn't get the Funk Brothers didn't get the attention, the names on the liner notes?
Well, it was sort of an industry-wide practice. You know, Motown in a lot of history books has been kind of unfairly singled out and reviled for that practice. But, you know, if you look at the albums on Roulette, you know, up in Chicago and the early Philly stuff, they just didn't give credits back then. The only one that got credit was the Stax Volk guys, because they made a conscious decision to market Booker T and EMGs as an act. But really nobody did it back then. The bad guy in this story is basically the fact that these guys existed about 20 years too early. And, you know, nowadays, if you're Steve Lukather or if you're Larry Carlton, you know, studio musicians like that, you become famous. But back then, you know, studio musicians were just thought of as role players who were, you know, janitors or something, just workaday guys, work for hire. Like, for instance, I have a union contract from one session they did on this particular day. In 3 hours, they cut Reach Out by the Four Tops, I'll Turn the Stone by the Four Tops, and With a Child's Heart by Stevie Wonder. And three hits in 3 hours. They used to cut a hit an hour. And James Jamerson got the princely sum of $60.41 for those three songs, which means Reach Out, which was one of the masterpieces of modern pop, was worth $20.14.
And no royalties.
No royalties.
Joe Hunter.
But that's the way things were. They were back then.
What, Joe Hunter, one of the things that's different, of course, was that the people who are an act, Booker T and the MGs, for an example, they will travel as an act. The Funk Brothers didn't travel with any musicians, did you guys?
No, we were given the opportunity to go. I think I took them to Buffalo, New York, Mary Wells, Smokey Robinson, The Miracles. and also to Cincinnati at the Regal Theater.
Right.
And up in Grant, it was part of Michigan, up near Saginaw, Michigan.
Yeah.
About three times. That was the only time that I really did something on the road with them. But most of the times I stayed here at home playing in church or whatever.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255 to Kill Devil Hills, North Carolina. Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Right.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I hear you fine.
Okay, I was on speakerphone. Yeah, I just like to say that I can't drive anymore, so I can't listen to the tubes on a radio or a disc or anything like that, but I still, when I ride my bicycle, I always think back to those days, and I sing those songs right out loud because I think the real essence of that music back then, and I mean the music from the instruments as well as the singing, was that sense of romanticism of, you know, no matter whether they're bad times or good times, there was always love. And I don't know whether it makes me laugh or cry. It makes that bicycle pedal a lot better.
I wonder, Paul, if you're like me. One of the producers here at the program came up to me and said, "You like Motown?" I said, "Yeah, I love Motown." He said, "Do you know who the musicians are who played it?" I said,
"Yeah."
I never thought about that.
Never knew.
And so when you hear it now, does it have a slightly different sound for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, slightly different. It's more appreciation. Certainly more appreciation. To know that these guys were putting in the time and effort like that, and they didn't get the credits, you know, but that they were the foundation that the person who sang, you know, got was able to sing from, you know, to look out a porch, you got to have a house to look out a porch from, and things like that. You ought to have the view. You got to have something to stand on, and those guys were the people that gave that essence to stand on.
And we're listening to some of that essence to stand on right now.
All right.
Sugar Pie Honey Bunch, I Can't Help Myself. Four Tops, 1965. Are you there, Paul?
I won't leave it.
We should just be quiet. Listen to these guys, right? You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Joe Hunter, you left the Funk Brothers early, 1963. Were you off to bigger and better things at that time?
Well, it goes both ways. Better things to an extent. I was making a little more money, you know.
That counts.
However, I was in a domestic affair with, you know, going through that divorce type of thing,
yeah,
with my lovely wife, and I left Motown really mostly because of a confusion of mind, because Barry had offered me opportunities to be just about what I wanted to be, but I just left, and, you know, and went with different ones, you know, Big Maybell, Jackie Wilson, Curtis Mayfield was producing for VJ Records over there. We cut Jerry Butler, Gene Chandler, and different ones out of VJ Records. And also we cut David Ruffin before he even joined the Temptations at Chess Records. And different people, you know. I just went on out because I was making a little better money at that time.
Right.
Later on, Motown started paying good money to the musicians after I left.
Is there a message there?
Had to get over the cap.
Oh, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Eric's on the line. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Gentlemen, I was a big fan of Stax Volt music and Muscle Shoals music. I wondered what your opinion was of those musicians and that sound. Did you see them as competition or allies?
No, by the time they showed up on the scene, we were hundreds of millions of records down the road. So they weren't competition, but a lot of people don't know that most of the stuff that you heard come out of Stax, well, Motown musicians recorded on top of it. They'd bring the tracks up to Detroit and put us on to sweeten it up for them.
Oh, my goodness. No, I didn't know that at all.
I know. Just like, you know the national anthem of Memphis, Tennessee, don't you?
No.
It's called Shaft. That's a nice record, isn't it?
It's all right.
Yeah, well, the guy that did the arrangement was from Motown.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, Johnny Allen.
No, it was a guy named Ted Shealy.
Oh, Ted Shealy.
Dale One was first.
Yeah, and Jack, for instance, played on Who's Making Love with Your Old Lady.
All of that.
While You're Out Making Love, which was Johnny Taylor, which was Stax.
Right. Bobby Bland, I played on all his stuff. Yeah. Carla Thomas, Rufus Thomas, I played. And Eddie Bongo and I. See, Eddie Bongo, the Kunga player, is from Memphis, Tennessee also. Well, he was. And we played on all that stuff.
Does it mean, Jack, that it was a much smaller world than the music industry today, that it was easy for someone to say, you know, we need that sharp talent in Detroit, and we're just going to bring it in?
They used to book hotel rooms and suites waiting for us to get an opportunity to play on that stuff.
Oh, you guys were, they were backed up waiting for you, were they?
They were backed up waiting, or they would fly us out when we had time on the weekend to Criteria Studio in Florida and put us on down there. We were Dr. John. You name it, if they were hitting, we were on it. Jackie Wilson, Boom Boom Boom. Everybody.
John Lee Hooker.
John Lee Hooker. We played on everybody. And, I mean, that's not bragging. That's what happened.
Well, it's actually one of the things that Alan talks about, Alan, that the Snake Pit, but the arrangers, the singers, the producers, they're killing to get access to this talent.
Well, yeah, because they knew that these guys would make him a hit. I mean, there were a lot of other musicians around Detroit, but these were the hit makers. And Burry played upon that fact because he liked to play different people off each other because it brought the best out of them. You know, all the competition right. between the songwriters. You didn't get paid if your song didn't make it to the radio, so he had nothing to lose. And the producers didn't get paid if their song didn't make it to the radio. So they were, you know, they pretty much tortured these guys. I mean, these guys had to hide out from the producers just to catch a break.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. The Funk Brothers, the music you're listening to right now, yeah, I know, The Miracles is the name on the label for Tears of a Clown, 1966, but it's the Funk Brothers who made it happen. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Give us a call. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, a conversation about the musical machine behind Motown, the Funk Brothers, brought in many ways to the attention of a wider audience by Alan Slutsky with a book he put out some 13 years ago called Standing in the Shadows of Motown, when he focused on the legendary bassist James Jamerson. It's soon to be released as a full-length documentary called Standing in the Shadows of Motown, featuring such people as Joe Hunter on keyboards and Jack Ashford on percussion and vibes. In fact, there's a part of the film where you actually get to listen and watch the magical sort of musical construction that the music behind Motown was. In fact, for this little part of the film, Jack Ashford, the magic tambourine man, is narrating. Let's listen.
Let me give you an example. We're going to take Ain't Too Proud to Babe, which I think everybody's familiar with. All right, Euro, give it to me. You and Pistol. Yeah, that feels right there. I'm going to put a little bass in there. One, two, three, four. All right. I'm going to bring a little bit of guitars in there for you. One, two, three, four. All right. Then we'll bring a little Johnny Griffin, a little keyboard in there.
One 800 423 8255. Connection listeners, that is the construction of the sound of Motown, the Funk Brothers. Jack, you sound like you're having so much fun as you're directing that.
I loved it. They had the best musicians in the world at your fingertips, man. That's pure bliss.
Did you know at the time, in the 60s, that what you were building was going to become a soundtrack for this country?
No, when you're making history, you're living it, so you don't know you're making it. You don't have a clue. We liked what we were doing. We liked each other. We liked what we were doing. And, we were so busy. Remember, we were cutting 7 days a week, and so it didn't leave much room for reflection. You know, it really didn't. That's the reason we didn't ask for more money.
Let's go to, where are we going? To Durham, North Carolina. Gregory's on the line. Hi, Gregory.
How are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
Listen, I tell you, that music was the greatest in the history of music, I think. I had friends, exchange students that came over from Europe, and when they heard me playing the Motown sound, they just flipped out. They loved it. So for Christmas, I had to send them Motown records. It crossed over so many different cultural lines, and I can tell you, I'm a bass player, and I play bass now because of James Jamerson. Because when I was 4, 5, 6 years old, I just loved that beat. Sometimes I wouldn't listen to the words. My ear was just trained to the beat of the bass.
Are you stand-up player or electric bass player?
I play both.
Yeah.
And I went to a music conservatory, and you got to thank James Jamerson for that. Because I wanted to be a bass player so bad, all because of him. But the Motown sound will live forever.
You're sure of that?
I'm positive.
There's something about it, eh?
Oh, yeah. I'm 100%. It'll live forever.
Alan, what is it about the sound that endures so well past music that's come and gone in the years since then?
Well, one of the reasons is that it was so effortless for these guys. And when you create high art, you know, like when you hear somebody who's struggling to play something, it makes you nervous. It makes you... you don't get the musical jolt that you would want. But these guys were such accomplished jazz musicians that this music was actually beneath them in terms of technique. So, it was so effortless to play, and that effortlessness it comes through in the music. So there's a certain joy. Like, for instance, the guys down at Stax Volt or some of the other, the Philly International guys, they came from blues and R&B backgrounds. So they didn't have that jazz training. And when you hear a song like How Sweet It Is, I mean, the swing on that is so strong that it could have only come from a guy who, had spent a lot of time in clubs playing Charlie Parker music and Count Basie things. And that spirit comes through on the records, and it makes people feel good. And when you feel good, everybody's happy. So that's the reason it endures. Someone's arms, and there you were. I needed someone to understand my ups and downs, and there you were. With sweet love and devotion, deeply touching my emotions.
Now, there were a couple of takes of that were Motown hits. There was one by Marvin Gaye in 64, Junior Walker in 1967. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, well, they had a formula. Like when they would have a hit with one song, they would shoot it out to a couple of the other artists because it would increase the publishing that came into Jobet, which was Motown's publishing arm. So, there's the recordings of the Miracles singing My Girl because it was just another hit on some money for the publishing.
Well, I heard it through the grapevine. Had the same kind of life, didn't it?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Right. That was Marvin. Well, originally, what was it? Marvin did originally...
Gladys Knight.
Yeah, I think.
Marvin didn't want to do it. Gladys Knight did, and she was so successful. Then Marvin Gaye did it. Is that how it works, Jack?
Yeah, or they banked. I forget what it was. I think they might have banked Marvin's copy. They didn't want to release it or something, and then Gladys put it out, and then they put out Marvin's or vice versa. But they had a lot of that. What's Going On, they didn't want to put it out either. Marvin had to practically threaten to leave the company to get What's Going On out. But, and they were both two totally different grooves. I mean, one came from a Latin place, which was the Gladys Knight version, and the other was had a spookier, straight-ahead rock feel.
Norman had told me that on Marvin's copy of Grapevine, that at that time when he did it on, and Marvin was needing a hit real bad. He really needed a hit, and Marvin and Norman collaborated, and Norman said, well, we know that Grapevine's a hit. Let me try this one. I got a different idea for it. And that's the reason it came such a difference, the way that he had done it, the way Gladys had done it. And so, it proved to be very successful.
Yeah, the Marvin version was also interesting because Benny was dying at the time. He was near the end. And he came to the studio and he couldn't hardly stand up. And nobody had the heart to send him home. So they just made him play some stuff on the cymbals. And then Ural and Pistol divided up the drums. Like Ural played the kick and the snare. And Pistol played the Indian War Dance on the tom-tom. So Heard It Through the Grapevine was actually three drummers.
Music of the Funk Brothers and 170 million pairs of lips across America all singing along with Marvin Gaye at the same time. To Cape Cod, Heather's on the line. Hi, Heather.
Hi.
Are you singing along?
Oh, my God. I love this music. When I am able to get a station that plays Motown, I know the songs. As soon as I hear the do-do-do-do, I know what it's going to be. I've heard it so many times, and I start singing before the song does. But I certainly don't sound as good. But it's one of those really joyful things from my childhood that always takes me back and brings a smile on my face.
Have you figured out though what it is that gives Motown that remarkable stature in your musical memory?
Well, the first word that came to my mouth when you said that was soul. It was just soul. It's just soul. It's just wonderful, wonderful music. Wonderful music.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Joe, Jack, you're not going to argue with the soul, are you?
I was listening to her voice. She sounded good on one of our tracks.
I'm getting over the flu. That's probably what you're hearing.
Well, that sounds soulful.
It's got a gravelly thing going on there, Heather.
Yes.
Oh,
yeah. Yes.
Anybody can sing one of our tracks and get a hit.
Oh, boy.
You have a career waiting for you just as soon as you get well.
Wasn't it the critic Steve Jordan who said, or the producer?
Right.
What did he say?
Yeah. I didn't want to say that to that
Debbity
lady.
The dog.
Yeah, he said you could put Debbity Dog on the tracks and you'd have
I didn't want to say that.
Because the tracks were so strong. See, that's a funny thing. See, I guess myself as a musician, I'm a little bit twisted. So the way I always looked at Motown was the story of an incredible studio band with a bunch of revolving vocalists. Which is a little different way of looking at it, but when you think about it, the Motown sound, when Smokey, for instance, performed on his own records or even on records that he produced or sang on as an artist, he was probably on more Motown records than anybody, and he was probably only on 30-40% of the output, whereas the other stars, like the Temps weren't there when it was a Four Tops record, or the Supremes weren't there when it was a Stevie record, but these guys were on every record. So when you say what's the Motown sound or what's the continuity that runs through the Motown sound, it's the Funk Brothers.
Heather's, are you still there, Heather? No, I think Heather's hung up.
Chased that one off.
You came on a little strong.
I was running my mouth too much.
I didn't know you could hear that. Chased that lady off.
Listen, I do want to sort of note something on a slightly more serious level that we started out when we were talking about Robert White, when you look down the list of the Funk Brothers, Joe and Jack, Earl Van Dyke has passed on, James Jamerson, Eddie Bongo Brown, Pistol Allen, Benny Benjamin, Robert White. About half the gang that was in the Snake Pit has passed on. And yet, when you guys get together, you can still make that sound.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that was, if there's a convenient way to die, which there isn't, but what made the Motown sound so much different than everything else was it was a very thick, orchestrated sound, like Stax Volt. You had one guitar, one bass, one piano, one drum. Whereas in Motown, most records had three guitarists. Most records had a couple of percussionists. Almost every record had two keyboardists, and sometimes they even had two drummers, two bassists. So the way these guys died, it was just by coincidence, one guy from each chair died. So you had one guitarist died, one drummer. So we still had a lot of firepower left, whereas if it had just worked out that three guitarists died, we'd be in trouble.
Jack, you still listen to the music?
Oh, yes. I listen to it more now because I'm getting ready to go on the road.
You're still playing?
Yes. Alan brought me out of retirement, out of mothballs, if you will. And it was, but I never did stop working on my chops occasionally, you know, at home, but I never played any gigs. I live in Memphis, and I never played a gig there. And sometimes I shy away from telling why I don't play any gigs there. Because, see, at Motown, when I was working for a little bit of money, I didn't mind because I had great guys to work with, and it was nice. Now that I know people are making more money, if I go out and do a gig, you got to give me more beer than and a barbecue sandwich and save me, I'm paid. It takes real money to pay me now, not those little trinkets, you know. And they don't pay much money down there, so I don't work.
Jack, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jack Ashford, percussion and vibes of the Funk Brothers. Joe Hunter, thank you for being a part of the program today.
It was a pleasure.
Joe Hunter, magic fingers on the keyboard, and Alan, Dr. Lick Slutsky, author, musician, and co-producer of Standing in the Shadows of Motown. I don't know if you're co-producer, but I know you had a lot to do with that, and I want to thank you for being part of the program.
I want to thank you for having us.
Giving us access to that fabulous music. A little bit to take us out. Holland Dozier, Holland, you keep me hanging on. Clean and Pure, the Funk Brothers. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.